Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in San Diego, California, and earned a degree in graphic design and advertising from the School of Visual Arts. She and her husband, Rob, moved to Detroit in 2008, and in the summer of 2009, she formed Humble Designs, whose mission is to step in when families feel there was nowhere else to turn. They furnish homes with donated goods, and they are currently doing 5 homes per week at an average cost of $1,200 per home. An advocate for the homeless, her name, Trigger Strasberg. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula, this is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to the CEO of Humble Designs, Trigger Strasberg. Trigger, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can we start by talking about your childhood in San Diego?
Sure.
And your mom and your dad.
Sure. I grew up in San Diego. I grew up in El Cajon, which is in the East County of San Diego. My father's an ophthalmologist, and my mom is a college professor. And I grew up, I had a lovely childhood, grew up with a big backyard and 2 golden retrievers, and it was... a really amazing upbringing. My parents now live in La Jolla, which, of course, I'm upset that they moved to La Jolla after I left the house. But okay. So, but they brought me up with a basic understanding of what it was to give back and what it was to feel empathy for other people. So I really attribute their upbringing to what I'm doing now.
What's the biggest thing you learned from mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from dad?
My mom was the one who instilled empathy. She always taught me to put myself in other people's shoes before passing judgment. So it was very hard for me my entire life to really be very judgmental with other people, because I always tried before I did that to say, well, how did they get to this decision? How did they get to the situation? So bullies and other things like that. In high school, for me, I felt more sorry for them than I felt angry. My father, he has a very strict set of morals. I remember one time I borrowed, quote unquote, a set of bowling shoes from the bowling alley by leaving my old pair of gross shoes there. And bowling shoes were in at the time, and they were very cool to wear to school. So I woke up one morning and I threw on my bowling shoes, and my dad sees me walk out the door and he goes, "Where did you get those?" And I said, "Well, I borrowed them from a bowling alley." And it was 7:30 in the morning on my way to school, and he drove me to that bowling alley to return the bowling shoes. At 13, I was mortified. But he always instilled that very strict set of morals in me. It was nice.
At 16, Trigger, you leave home in San Diego, and you moved to Israel yourself.
I did.
To attend high school.
I did.
Why?
That's a good question. Every summer I had an adventure. My parents always either sent me away to, I went to Wellesley, I went to Rhode Island School of Design, I went to camp. So that summer was supposed to be an adventure in Israel. And what ended up happening is I walked the Old Testament with a group of teenagers. Muslims, Christian, Jewish teenagers, and we walked the Old Testament and we learned a lot about it. And it was an adventure that my parents had set up for me. What they didn't expect was that on the day that I was supposed to come home, I made a phone call to them and said, I love you guys, but I don't want to come back. I want to figure out how to stay here for longer. I was so tied to the land, tied to the people, and I had never felt that deeply about anything before. And so I found, my mom and I both found a high school that would give me my American diploma, and I stayed.
Speaking of which, tell us about Israel and the Israeli people.
So... everyone, when I say that I went to Israel, everyone says, "Oh, well, were you scared when you were there? Were you afraid?" And this is how I best phrase it, is when you are in America, you don't leave your purse on your chair when you go to the bathroom when you're in a restaurant. You don't walk down a dark alley at night by yourself. When you're a woman, you don't walk on the same side of the street as a van, because we've been taught that that's dangerous. In Israel, all those things. People leave their front doors open when they're not home so people can come in and get water. You never are fearful of anyone attacking you. You're fearful of the bomb on the bus. So the fears are different, but I felt much safer in Israel, personally. And as a woman, I felt much, much more, much safer in my everyday life.
Your freshman year of high school, your first year there, you run a dairy farm.
Yeah.
You graduate high school, and then you move to New York City on your own to attend the School of Visual Arts.
I like how you say on your own, like my parents should come with me to college. But yes, I did.
They were not helicopter parents, that's for sure.
No, thank goodness. No, I went to New York City, which was a huge culture shock from Israel. I remember my first night in New York City, I was sitting on the stoop of my dorm in, I was in Gramercy Park, and I was sitting on the stoop of my dorm, and a gentleman walked by, shuffling by with his pants around his ankles. And in my head, I said, welcome to New York City. But it was an amazing 4 years. It was, best of all, because I met my husband.
In your sophomore year, you call your mom and dad one day and say, Mom, Dad, I'm coming home for the holidays, and I'm bringing a boy. His name's Rob Strasberg, and oh, by the way, he's my college professor.
I just cringed a little bit, yes.
What'd they say?
My mom wanted to kill me. If she could have reached through the phone and strangled me, she would have. My mom, being a college professor and education being very important to both my parents, thought I was going to get thrown out of school for dating, which was a legitimate, I believe, at the time. But it wasn't like that. And Rob is only 8.5 years older than I am. So it wasn't like it was that big of a disparity. But I brought him home, and they instantly fell in love with him. And he's wonderful and fantastic. And we have two lovely kids together. So it all worked out.
We're talking to Trigger Strasberg. When we come back, we'll ask why she and Rob and the two young children moved to Detroit in 2008. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Trigger Strasberg, who in 2008, with her husband Rob, moved to the Detroit area with their two infant children. Why?
What a good question. So I was living in Miami with my husband, and he had a very demanding job. Extraordinarily long hours, traveling all the time, and I had two little kids, little babies with him. And so we decided that it was time for a life change, and he needed to find a job that had more flexibility as far as his hours were concerned. So he got job offers in New York City, which we were very comfortable with. We'd live there. And he got a job offer in LA, which I was so excited about because my family's in San Diego. So he said to me, but I have this one job offer in Detroit, and they're willing to put you up at a nice hotel for the weekend. And I know your mom will come in and take care of the kids. So let's just go. Let's just have a weekend. And I said, okay. Never in my wildest dreams did I expect that we would end up in Detroit. In my mind, I thought we were going to pull into burned out buildings and desolation and really everyone warned me, be careful when you go to Detroit, you know. So when I got here, honestly, the first place that we pulled into was Birmingham. And I was like, well, what is this charming little lovely town? What's going on? It was nothing like what I'd seen on the news and 60 Minutes and all the, you know, the CNN pieces I've been watching. So I walked around the town. It was January 20th. So it was blanketed in snow and the lights were twinkling. And I thought, well, there, if this is what this suburb looks like, I am dying to see what the other suburbs look like. So I rented a car and drove around. And I went to I went to Franklin and Royal Oak and Ferndale. And then I went down into the city. And I was amazed. I was truly amazed at what I was seeing. And even in the city where I was supposed to be careful and it was supposed to, you know, all these horrible stories, it was even amazing to me because I saw the revival and I went and I saw the artwork. And that night, Rob and I went down to the Fox Theater and saw live music. And it was incredible. And so We didn't even talk about the job, really. And then the last day that we were here for 3 days. And I said, well, I hope this is a job you can get into that you like, because I really want to move here. It was a great decision.
And in early 2009, you meet a lady, Nancy Fishman.
Yes.
Who was on the show a few years ago. She's the founder of Forgotten Harvest, which is now the second largest such operation in America. Mm-hmm. It's distributing 24.5 million pounds of rescued food to 160-plus emergency food providers in Southeast Michigan. Mm-hmm. Tell us about Nancy Fishman.
She's my mentor and just really the reason I am where I am now. She, I told her at one point, we were having lunch, and I said, Nancy, I am an engine that needs a track. I am a train that needs a direction. You need to just put me on something, and I will go for it. I just want to do good. So she said, well, go volunteer down at Forgotten Harvest, and I'm sure they could use your skills. So my kids were in school at Temple Bethel for 3 hours a day from 9 to noon. So when I went out and looked in the job market for graphic design and advertising, nobody was willing to hire a woman from 9 to noon. Believe that or not, I was astounded by that bit of information. Anyway, so I went down to Forgotten Harvest and I volunteered from 9 to noon. And I did their Facebook and I did some of their graphic design. But really what I did was I got to understand what it is to be a nonprofit and a very successful one. So every day I would go out to lunch or coffee, and I would see the woman at the front desk. Her name was Krista, is Krista, and we became friendly. And one day we were in a friend's office, and she was just not her normal bubbly self. And I said, well, Krista, what's going on? And she said, well, me and my two kids were going to be homeless. And if you had pushed me over right then, I would have fallen down to the ground. I mean, I couldn't believe it. Here's a woman who had it all together, had a job, and I mean, she was my contemporary. She was my friend. I you know, we had a lot of things in common. So my first instinct is like, well, no, that's just not going to happen. How do we prevent all of this from happening? How do I give you a big hug and keep you from this? So there in that one moment was born Humble Design.
All right, you tell Rob I got to help this person.
Yeah.
Rob says, okay.
Sure.
You'll be this engine, you know, for one day from 9 till noon. But then you decide to start Humble Designs. Tell us about Humble Designs.
Okay. So in that moment, I had met a woman named Anna Smith, and she had volunteered for an organization in San Francisco. And what they did was they furnished homes for AIDS patients who were living out the last days of their lives in San Francisco and needed a comfortable home. And a lot of these AIDS patients were either previously homeless or very poor. So she took recycled furniture and furnished their homes. So I said, well, wouldn't that be great if we made a model of that here in Detroit, but for families? And there's so much desolation and need in Detroit, they certainly would need that. So Anna was on board, and I was on board, and we had sort of talked about it in the abstract. And then sat across from me this woman, Krista, who was in need. She was the one person I looked to, and I said, I can do this. I see a face, I see a person, I can identify the need, and I can help. So Anna and I got together, and we decided to make Krista's house our mission to furnish. She, Krista found a home through Forgotten Harvest. Another colleague there was trying to sell their home and decided to rent it to Krista. And so she got the house, but of course, in the interim of moving and being thrown out of one place and being homeless, she had lost everything, all of her worldly belongings. So I didn't know that many people. But who I did know, I annoyed and called and said, hey, do you have a coffee table? I need a bed. I need sheets. I need pots, pans, shelf liner, artwork. So it took us 6 weeks, and we had a pickup truck that was Anna's that she she used. And we drove around, the two of us, and hauled furniture away from people's garages and storage units. And by the time we were done, I had power washed the deck, I had shelf lined, I was cleaning her house, I was over at her house more than I was at my own. And we were done. We wiped our hands and said, okay. And then I went back to Forgotten Harvest, and Anna went back to her kids and her life. And then I would drive home at the end of the day, and there would be a couch pushed onto my front lawn, or a crib rolled into my garage, or sheets piled at my front door, because someone had told someone what we were doing and decided that they wanted to give us the furniture for that reason. Well, we had no longer any need for that furniture, so I started calling up shelters, and Anna and I had very specific goals for that furniture. Number one, we did not want it to be resold. We wanted it to go directly to families in need. Number two, we did not want the families in need to have to pick it up or be charged for drop-off. And number three, we wanted it to be delivered with love, more panache than just throwing up furniture on people. I think it was 9 shelters we called, all had the same reaction. They said, oh, you should start that. You should do that. That's a huge hole in our system. You should do that. I had no intention of starting a nonprofit. That was never my intention. So by the 9th phone call, Anna and I looked at each other and said, I guess we're starting a nonprofit.
It's estimated, Trigger, that there's 3.5 million homeless in America, estimated 20,000 in Detroit alone. Talk to us about the typical formula to homelessness.
Well, let me just say, to begin with, that it's a lot different than what I had started out believing. My image of homelessness in my mind was, I had believed almost all homeless were either bordering on mental illness or full-fledged mental illness or drug abuse. That was what I had in my head. I don't know where I got that from, but that's the image that I had. Let me just say that 85% of the families that we help are victims of domestic violence. There are women and children. We have had, of 400 families, we've had maybe less than 5% with drug issues. This is an issue that's an epidemic in America that does not target what it used to just target. This homeless population has grown because of the lack of jobs and the economy and people coming home from Iraq and serving in the military, not getting the care that they need, and then passing it along, those problems, to their families. We deal with a lot of women and children, and what I hear a lot of is medical bills. I get that a lot. A lot of, I lost my job and can't find another job, and actively looking for jobs. A lot of our families have college degrees. A lot of our families have higher than high school education and associate's degrees. It blows my mind what we run into. Families, full families, the husband and wives that are together that are both veterans. We just had a family of 6, husband and wife, both veterans, homeless, with 6 kids.
We're talking to Trigger Strasburg. If you want to learn more, www.humbledesign.org. Humbledesign.org. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Trigger Strasburg, CEO of Humble Designs, which currently has 9 employees, and they're doing 5 homes per week at an average cost of $1,200 per home.
Mm-hmm.
Trigger, how do you identify and select new families?
We discovered at the very beginning of this process that we don't know enough about what's going on in the shelters to select our families. We just don't have our ear to the ground. But the social workers inside the homeless shelters know. They know who's coming in. They know who's been there a lot of times. They know who's going to be able to rise themselves up and out of homelessness. And they know who's going to continue on with the cycle. So we ask them to provide our clients for us. And we ask them to use their best judgment. And we really give them the power. We empower the social workers, especially social workers that we have a longstanding relationship with, to recommend our clients to us. There are certain, we have 13 different partnering agencies. There are certain partnering agencies like the Empowerment Plan, who's run by Veronica Scott, and they make coats for the homeless that turn into sleeping bags. Any sewer that comes through, that she employs women who used to be in COTS, which is a homeless shelter. And so any woman that she employs, we automatically will furnish their home for them. So she already vets her women who work for her. But mostly we just rely on the people who know the people best, which are the social workers.
How do you find, or how do these shelters find homes for these clients?
So when you...
5 a week.
Well, it's much more than that. I mean, our waiting list is hundreds of people, you know. But so what happens when you go to a homeless shelter is you are assigned a social worker or a caseworker, and their goal is to get you out of the homeless shelter. They do not want you in there for a long period of time. It costs the city money. It costs them money. So what they are, their goal is to find you either Section 8, which is government-aided housing, or housing that you can afford. And so as soon as that happens, the moment that that happens, that's when we get the call or the email to put them on our waiting list. When they locate the housing, usually they come in, and you can imagine if they don't have money for a house, they don't have money for a storage unit to house all their furniture that they had before or even their clothing. So when they move into these houses, almost every, I want to say 100%, but it's not 100%. It's more like 90% of our families have nothing, have two trash bags of clothing and no furniture.
Your two children, you and Rob, mm-hmm. Tuesday and Henson.
Yeah.
Do they regularly tell you, Ma, somebody else dropped off a couch this morning on the front yard? Are they still bringing the furniture to the house?
Occasionally, I will have people call me and say, you know, I can't make it down to your warehouse. Can I drop it in the garage? And I always say yes, because I go there to the warehouse all the time. But they are more aware of their own stuff that they give away. They hand me stuff every day of their own toys and clothes that they want to give to Humble, that they want to see donated.
You're doing 5 homes, you and your 9 teammates. 5 homes per week cost you $1,200 per home. How do you keep coming up with enough furniture?
Oh, the furniture's not the problem. You can imagine. Okay, let's just take a blanket of all of the suburbs in around Detroit. Bloomfield Hills, Bloomfield, Birmingham, Royal Oak. Imagine how many people there are overturning furniture, redecorating. We've got Gorman's dropping off furniture. Now we have a new partnership with Art Van. Dinged furniture that doesn't sell on the floor. Furniture's not the problem.
Tell us about your 9 teammates.
Well, certainly they are very special people because, A, they are passionate about what they do. They are the ones in the trenches, in the homes, meeting with the families, decorating, running the warehouse. And, B, they work for peanuts. I mean, we're not getting rich off this operation, I'll tell you that. I've never taken a salary, and my staff barely takes a salary. But they are passionate about what they do because they are on the ground floor. They get to see the good that they do. They get to see the faces of the families when they come home and see this house full of furniture. And I feel almost at a disadvantage now that I'm in the office and I have to raise money and I have to do the back end work, because every once in a while I need to be reminded of how important it is to see the good that we do and to be able to continue every day to do it.
Speaking of which, if you're doing 5 homes a week at 1,200, that's 6,000. Times 4, that's 24,000. You got some overhead. It's at least 50, 60, 70,000 a month.
At least. Yeah.
How do you raise the money?
We're creative. We like social media a lot, Facebook and our website. But really, it's one-on-one relationships with people who want to get involved. When people donate money to a cause, they want to know where their money's going, and they want to make sure that it's doing the most good. So when people donate money to our cause, they can see the family that they helped. If you donate $1,200, I can introduce you to the family. You can look on our website and see the before and after pictures. You can see the children. It is a direct correlation between money versus the good that comes out of it.
I think if Rob was here, he'd say, Jack, not only doesn't she take a penny in compensation,
it costs him so much money.
She's every time I see her, she wants more money. True.
Rob never feels like it's his money. It's always our money. But yes, we do spend. I wouldn't say that it's spending money. we're going to donate money. Rob and I feel are the type of people that feel that the more blessed that we are, the more blessed we should pass on to other people. We should bless other people with it. So we're going to do something with our money that makes us feel like we're giving back. So why not give back where I can directly have control of how we're spending that money and how much good we're doing? I mean, I feel like I'm saving him money in the end, really.
That's chutzpah. Gorman's Art Van Furniture.
Yeah.
These furniture companies must have your picture on their corporate walls, and they say wanted for theft and extortion. Keep out.
You would think.
What do they say when they see you coming?
Gorman's has been amazing. Gorman's has had a relationship with us since almost the beginning, where when something doesn't sell on their floor, they donate it to us. Now, we have this relationship with them where normally the stuff that would be shipped back to China or back to the manufacturer when it doesn't sell on the floor actually costs less to donate to us and to get the tax write-off. Now, I don't know if that's a line that they're selling me or if that's the truth, but we are so grateful that almost on a weekly basis, we get gorgeous Gorman's furniture coming in. I mean, amazing stuff.
Knowing you, I think your definition of any furniture that doesn't sell, if it doesn't sell within 48 hours. Okay.
Bring it over.
Trigger Strasberg, you're like Lucy Arnaz working in the chocolate factory where she's eating them chocolates. You can't keep up. You can't put a dent into these 20,000 homeless people just in Detroit. It's futile.
When people ask me if I'm making a difference in Detroit, what I answer is always the same. I made a difference this week in the Davis family. Their lives will never be the same. If you ask the Davis family if I'm making a difference, they will say yes. Last week, if you asked the Ediths, they would say yes. We are making a difference in lives, not cities. I don't like to look at it. I don't like to look at it as a futile experiment, because if you talk to these families individually, they would tell you it's anything but futile. I also like to think that because of what we do, we're keeping people from returning to the shelters. Our statistics are amazing at how many people without our help return to the shelters and with our help stay in their homes. Now, if you look at it that way and it has a dollar sign on it, every family that goes to the shelters costs the city a lot of money. If we can keep those families in their homes and working to pay their rent and pay their bills, we must be doing the city some kind of a service.
We're talking to Trigger Strasberg. You want to learn more? www.humbledesign.org. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything is Possible, and we're talking to Trigger Strasberg, CEO of Humble Designs. Trigger, many people would say what you and your teammates are doing is impossible. What do you say to them?
We're doing it. How is it impossible? I'm making it happen every day. We're out on the streets. You see the Humble truck driving around. It's happening. Look at it. It's happening.
What have these homeless people taught you?
I love the name of my company because it is entirely 100% true that it keeps me humble. It keeps me grateful, and it keeps me humble, and it keeps me grounded in my life. And I get to meet the most amazing people. I am so blessed that I get to meet these families and understand their stories. One day I'm going to write a book on all their stories and how they got to where they are, because they are amazing people.
As I've had guests through the years that have worked with the poorest of the poor, one thing they always say is that they've learned much more from the poor than they ever did from the rich.
Oh, yeah.
Why?
The struggle is there. The struggle is real. And, you know, art and Renaissance and it all comes from struggle. And sometimes, and I see a lot of this going on with the children around me and you know, my kids' friends, is they're not aware of the struggle. Things come very easily. Life is laid out on a silver platter. And when you see the struggle, you learn. You learn and you grow.
It's obvious you're a very talented young business
well, thank
lady.
Thank you.
You're a sales lady. You don't take no for the answer. You're a natural leader. You make things happen. You're a difference maker. Some would say you're wasting your talents. You could get rich running a business.
I have been in the advertising and graphic design sector. I've worked at other jobs and I've been paid before. And I love doing that. I love the creative work of it. But I've never felt wealthier than I do now. I have never felt more fulfilled or more at peace with my life or my surroundings than I do now. And I realized from a very young age that I won't be happy until I make the people around me happier.
Trigger Strasberg, what is an angel?
Oh, Lord. I don't even know the answer to that question. In my experience, somebody who can wrap their arms around a situation and other people and make them feel better and more at home and keep their spirits up.
When you get up in the morning and you look in the mirror, you're looking at it.
Certainly don't feel that way, but I appreciate the sentiment.
What if there's a listener tonight who has just lost everything? What do you say to him?
Just even saying that out loud just puts my heart in my stomach. Just you saying that out loud. And there are people out there who want to help you. You have to ask for help. You have to look for help. People who isolate themselves and think that just because they're in this situation, they're alone. You're never alone. And what I've realized from every church in this town, every temple, every social service, every wealthy person who gives their time and their money back to the city, there are people out there who want to help you. You have to ask for help.
Ernie Banks once told me that you can live without food for a month.
Mm-hmm.
You can live without water for about a week.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't live without hope for a minute. Trigger, what is hope?
When we first encounter our families, a lot of the mothers, their posture, their shoulders are slumped, their eyes are glazed over. Sometimes they have holes in their clothes and they haven't brushed their hair, or they're just sitting on a milk crate when we come over. I see the loss of hope. It's like a gray wash over them, like they've been scrubbed too hard in the washing machine and all the color has drained out of them. But the second visit, when we come back after the furniture's been delivered, that's hope. They see that things are going to change and they can think past the next day, the next hour. They don't have to think, how am I going to get my kids dressed for school the next morning? They start thinking, what am I going to do with my life? What am I going to do to get myself out of the situation? And their shoulders are back and their chin is up and they've taken pride in their appearance that day and they hug me when I come in. And just to provide that one moment or that one brief glimmer of hope is worth more than all the furniture that we put in there.
A listener says, wow, this is a special young lady. Great confidence, can-do attitude, chutzpah.
Got to come in here every day for all these compliments. I love it.
How do I get that in my life?
As a person who's at the precipice of starting their lives and choosing their career and going through college, I think almost every young person has to have that one epiphany of, I want to do good for the community and the world around me, and I want to do good for my family and make money. And how to combine those two, I think it is a growing trend, especially around Detroit, of how to balance those two. And I think in 10 years, you're going to see every company in every community doing both of those things in equal amounts, giving back to their community and making money. And you can see it all over Detroit. We have unbelievable business models. And as a young person growing up and trying to make and having ideals and trying to make a difference, don't lose that. becoming an adult doesn't mean giving in to the system and just continuing a life of the grind and making money. If you can keep that young, wide-eyed innocence of wanting to change the world and putting one foot in front of the other, you can do it. Anybody can do it.
Most people would say our vets aren't homeless. These are some of our best. We are losing 22 of them a day to suicide. But tell us about the vets that you've encountered and helped.
We have had lots of women who say that my husband left for Iraq or Afghanistan, a good man. He left as a responsible, upstanding citizen, and he came back a drug addict. And I think that there's a huge drug problem going on, and I think also when they come home, those resources aren't there for them to help them in the immediate to either recover from a drug problem or recover from PTSD. And then it really resonates in their family. Their families are waiting for them to come home and are hopeful and come home, and their hopes are dashed, and their breadwinner is not able to recover from this trauma. And I don't think our country has been there to hold them and to cradle them in this time of need when they come home. I think we've done a huge disservice to our veterans. I see it every day.
If Rob was here, he'd probably say, Jack, don't ask her this question. But
oh, goodness.
What are your dreams?
You know, it's Rob and I, we've both been talking about this, and he has this dream as well, is to take this national. We want to help. And we have the business model. It works. Listen, we started off in the city with the most need. Why did we do that? Why didn't we start off in Austin, Texas, or in San Diego, where it was a manageable need? We started off in Detroit, where the need is like the sun. It's ever blazing. But we are making a difference here, and we set up a business model that works. Why can't we do that in every city in America?
As our time winds down together, What advice would you give to our young listeners, Tweaker?
Please, please, I'm begging you, stay true to your country and your community, and make the time and make the effort in your lives to find a way to connect with people who need you. You will get more out of that than you ever will going to a job 9 to 5 every day. If you can just make that time, your life will allow for it.
Trigger Strasberg, you're a living, breathing, walking angel. Keep up the great, great
Thank
work.
Thank you so much for having me.
Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall. Believe.